Hello and welcome to the Vitamin Research Products Call on Epicor. Our speaker today is Dr. Alex Shouse, the Director of Natural and Medicinal Products Research for AIBMR Life Sciences Incorporated. Dr. Shouse has studied nutrition and botanical medicine for 30 years and has worked closely with the product Epicor. He will be sharing the Epicor story with us today. And Dr. Shouse, I'd like to turn the floor over to you.
Thank you, Maria. The study that I'm going to describe to you on Epicor began over 3 years ago. At that time, we had an inquiry from a company in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, that they had discovered an unusual low rate of illness among a group of employees at their company. They made this discovery when some years earlier the company went self-insured, and as a result, their actuaries and underwriters required them to set aside a certain amount of money that was necessary to cover anticipated health expenses for their employees. But each year, they discovered that they had set aside far more money than was necessary based on actual healthcare expenditures. This continued until a point where they noticed that they had a zero increase in healthcare costs, which is extraordinarily unusual today. And so we were contacted because they thought it was possible that one of the fermentation products they were working with were around the cluster of employees that had this unusual lack of illnesses. So I went out to Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I looked over the manufacturing facility, and I started doing some interviews with employees that had these unusual low incidences of sick leave or illness. I started with the plant manager, who had previously worked at Cargill for over 20 years, then joined the company. He has a background in chemical engineering. And he mentioned that he had been at the company now 9 years, that his wife was an emergency room nurse, that typically while he was at Cargill, she would bring various infectious agents into the family's home, and he, his wife, and the children would come down with somewhere between 3 to 5 colds or flus a year. Since the time that he worked at the facility, he has not had a single cold or flu in 9 years, regardless of what infectious agents are spreading in the community. But his wife, the nurse, and his children continue to get whatever illness the nurse was bringing home. As I went around and met with other staff, I had heard exactly the same story. But some of the most impressive ones were people that had been there for 25 or more than 30 years and had never taken a day off for sick leave. There have been no admissions for any emergency room visits. There have been no incidences of any chronic diseases. And so I met with the management and said, you know, it seems like there may be some reason to investigate the fermentation product further, because after listening to some of the staff in the administrative buildings, we found that they had the typical 2, 3, 4 colds, flus a year that we would expect. Of course, not all, but at least 35 to 50% of the rest of the employees in the company did have seasonal infectious agents that affected them and their family, versus a total absence of those among those who were working around the fermentation product. So that's the way the study of Epicor actually began. The thing that we decided to do, and this is how we do our research, is we begin by the characterization and fractionation of the product in question. And so we started off with a fractionation analysis. And what we found was a very interesting ingredient that was the end product of fermentation. The fermentation begins with Saccharomyces cerevisiae, a very common yeast, also known as baker's yeast, brewer's yeast. And it goes through a series of fermentation stages. And during this time, what they're figured out is a way of preventing the cells from breaking, but stressing them enough to create a property that has immune-enhancing properties for animals. They have been producing this product for 63 years. They distribute it all over the world. So they have facilities from Spain to China. And they have had enormous success selling this product in very minute amounts when added to animal feed products to help production animals reach the production stages to maximize profit for those involved in animal production. An example would be if a pig had 9 piglets, one or two may die, but when Epicor was added to the feed grain, none die, and all remain healthy, and that is the reason why this company has dominated in the animal feed area this product, and no one has ever been able to replicate it. So how the fermentation is made is covered under a trade secret. It is not patented. No one has been able to figure out how to make the product. Many companies have tried. All have failed. Some of the companies that have tried are in the multi-billion dollar category, and they have given up. So they've done a very, very good job of maintaining a trade secret. Well, we were interested in looking at the characterization to identify things that might explain why Epicor had this immune-enhancing effect or immune-modulatory effect. And as we got more and more into breaking down the composition of the product, we started noticing some very interesting things. First of all, it had the usual complement of protein, carbohydrates, and lipids. For example, when we looked at the lipids, we noticed it had an excellent profile of monounsaturated, polyunsaturated fatty acids and a small amount of saturated fat. When we looked for vitamins and minerals, we saw all of the essential vitamins were in the product, all of the essential minerals, even trace elements, were in the product. But it got really interesting as we started getting into different compounds. For example, we looked at phytosterols. And when we started looking at the phytosterols, we found things that would normally be found in a number of botanical products that are known to exert considerable free radical scavenging abilities. We also found unusual compounds like squalene, which is not normally found but in a few species and plants on this earth. Certain species of sharks, for example, have squalene. And yet we were finding this inside of the cells of these products, of the Epicor. So since there were a lot of total phenolics in this, catechins, pyrogallol, transresveratrol, things of this nature in their fermentation product, we decided to subject it to some antioxidant assays. The first thing that we did is we did an inhibition of radical oxygen species formation study using freshly purified human neutrophils, or human cells that are neutrophils. We incubated these, and then we diluted different concentrations of Epicor and exposed them to an ROS-sensitive dye. If you're familiar with the ROS procedure, you know that you challenge samples with hydrogen peroxide to induce severe oxidative stress. And then you measure the levels of the fluorescence intensity to compare them with the untreated and challenged cells in the presence or absence of the extract, which in this case was Epicor. And when we did this, we discovered that we could go down to a dilution starting at 10 parts per million and ending at 1 part per trillion, and we continued to have very significant reduction of ROS formation compared to control cells challenged with the hydrogen peroxide. We continued even at past 1 part per trillion until we could find no further effective ROS inhibition at a concentration of 0.01 part per trillion. So this initially suggested to us that Epicor may be effective in inhibiting ROS formation. Next, what we did is we looked at a rather simple study in which we looked at the antimicrobial effect of Epicor, thinking, okay, is it effective against pathogenic bacteria? We looked at bacteria like E. coli and a fungus called Candida tropicalis, which you find worldwide, and that's associated with quite a few illnesses. And we also even looked at normal oral bacteria. And the results were, in using petri dishes as an in vitro model, we found significantly reduced growth of E. coli and C. tropicalis. In fact, it was dramatic. At concentrations that continued all the way down to one part per billion, we had total inhibition of E. coli and Candida tropicalis. We next decided to just start looking at the stability of the product, because they typically add it into feed grain, they ship it out in rail carts, it's then bagged and distributed all over the world, and it's rather rapidly consumed. But if the intention is for it to sit on shelves for human consumption, then stability and shelf life studies became important. So one of the things we do in that area is we do inoculated and non-inoculated stability tests, and we perform these at 25 degrees centigrade or 73 to 77 degrees Fahrenheit, which is a typical ambient temperature with additional humidity, and then we analyze it for aerobic bacteria, lactic acid, bacteria, yeast, and mold, and in the inoculated, we actually expose it to pathogenic organisms to see what would happen over a 28-day period. The results of those tests found that the material was stable. It did not cause an increase in Salmonella, Staph aureus, and et cetera when we inoculated it. And we have performed shelf life stability studies now that have gone on for 22 months. And we find it microbiologically safe and has at least almost now a two-year shelf life stability. We also looked at pesticides. It's obvious that there could be things in there that might have pathogenic effects, cytotoxic in nature, and we used a leading lab in the United States to perform FDA and USP panels looking at 139 analytes. What we're basically looking for are pesticides, three classes in particular, organophosphates, organonitrogen, and I believe it's organochlorides. And we also looked at other things like carbonates, thiocarbonates, piperonal, butoxide. And anyway, the end result was that Epicor was found free of all 139 compounds, pesticides that we were looking for at the detection limits. We then performed a 14-day oral toxicity study in the rat. We went up to 2,000 milligrams of Epicor per kilogram of body weight. We do these in 20 rats, 10 males, 10 females. This is approximately about 140 grams acutely administered orally in a human male. Then we observed them for 14 days. We euthanized them on day 15, and they're then subjected to a gross pathological examination. We found on the limit test, which is what the 14-day test is known as, that they had normal body weight gain, no deaths occurred, no toxic clinical symptoms appeared, no gross pathological changes were observed. So at least at that quote-unquote toxic high dose in a mammal species, Epicor came out fine. We then continued on and performed a subchronic 90-day oral toxicity study with histopathologies. Here we used four groups of rats where there were 40 per group, 20 males and 20 females. Each was force-fed by gavage, either 30, 200, or 1,500 milligrams of Epicor per kilogram of body weight for 90 days, and we also had a control group. The results were that the rats treated with Epicor showed no mortality, no treatment-related clinical symptoms, no significant differences in body weight for for food and water consumption compared to the controls. We saw no pathological changes in the eyes, no changes in sensory reactivity, grip strength, motor activity, no changes in hematological parameters, which is the hemodynamics, or thrombotin time. There were no changes in serum or urine metabolic parameters. No gross pathological lesions were found in any of the organs, which included digestive, respiratory, circulatory, urinary, endocrine, reproductive, nervous, both central and peripheral, and lymphoid systems. So the end result is, based on this study, Epicor was well tolerated in daily oral doses of up to 1,500 milligrams per kilogram, which would be well over 100 grams administered a day of this product. So the no observed adverse effect level, the no, what we call the NOEAL or NOEL, in rats is higher than 1,500 milligrams per kilogram consumed for 90 days. For those of you who are familiar with these tests, you know that a 90-day test in the rat is approximately allometrically equivalent to 1.5 years of human consumption in a 70-kilogram adult male or in a 50-kilogram adult female. We then performed a bacterial reverse mutagenicity test, which is commonly called the Ames test. This test we did with using the bacterial reverse mutation assay method. We had four strains of Salmonella, along with two E. coli strains, so we used six altogether, both in the presence and absence of an exogenous metabolitic activation system. And so we then tried different concentrations, starting at 10 micrograms up to 1,000 of Epicor per plate, to look for any problems. And we found no evidence of mutagenic activity detected for Epicor in any of the tested strains. We also did it according to US FDA 21 CRF 58 format, so that it was done with confirmation. Because of those results, and those are done in eukaryote cells, we were interested in further studying potential mutagenicity using a mammalian model, and so we used the mouse lymphoma L5178Y cell mutagenicity assay, basically, again, to certify genotoxic potential of Epicor, but in this case, using the mammalian cell mutation assay system. We did two trials, again, this following an OECD, FDA, as well as EC model, and we found that there was no evidence of induction of gene mutation by Epicor in any of the experiments that were performed. The respective control treatments produced significantly higher increases in the frequency of mutants under identical conditions. So the end results of the combined two tests would suggest that Epicor is not mutagenic and it does not have the potential to cause gene mutation. We also are very well aware, especially in the United States, that a high percentage of adults, especially as they get older, are on various types of medication. So since the average is 42% of adult Americans are on some prescription drugs, the question we raised was whether there may be some contraindications or some effects on drug metabolizing enzymes. So we did an immortalized hepatocyte assay, which is considered a gold standard for looking at a way of inducing activity of drug metabolizing enzymes, things like the cytochrome P450-1A2 or 3A4, using immortalized human hepatocyte cells. This has been used by US FDA since the early 90s, and almost every drug company subjects their promising compounds to this particular assay. We used FA2N4 cells. They were either treated with Epicor or not. DMSO is used as a negative control, and there are certain positive controls, certain drugs like rifampin, on this assay. And what we found was that Epicor does not is not toxic to FA2N4 cells. It does not induce the expression or enzymatic activity of CYPs, and it did not interfere in drug metabolism. These results indicate that the test product is not toxic to human hepatocytes and does not have cytochrome P450 enzyme-inducing potential. However, that's fine, but we thought it would be good to do a human pharmacokinetic study, and rather doing a traditional three to four day weekend type human pharmacokinetic study, we decided to do one for 1 month. The reason I was interested in doing this, as you'll see here shortly, is I wanted to see what kinds of changes in immune function or immune parameters occurred over a four-week period. So we did this work at Radiant Research, which is regarded as one of the best pharmacokinetic companies in the country. And we did this with 15 men and women who were aged 18 to 40 who met all of the criteria to receive 500 milligrams of the test product in a single daily dose for 30 days. And, of course, we took a lot of baseline values over 3 days preceding the experiment, and then we did multiple blood samples, which were taken on day 2 and day 28 for pharmacokinetic profiling, following administration of ALPZ, which is alprazolam, and dextromethorphan. And those are the common ways of doing it. We also did additional blood and saliva samples that were taken at day 0, 14, 21, and 28, which were sent to a specialized laboratory in Los Angeles that has been doing immune assays for nearly 25 years and whose director is affiliated with UCLA. And we, of course, looked for vital signs and any adverse events. And what we found was that Epicor was very well tolerated. We found no significant changes in the subjects. There was no evidence of any significant adverse effect on the immune system, and there was no evidence of any treatment effect of Epicor on any hematological or serum chemistry variable, nor clinically relevant changes of any vital signs. So we're very, very pleased that those results came out. Now, it turns out, as I'm going to get into this now, that, and let me just summarize where we've gotten at this point, and then I'm going to show you a very interesting study that we did that fits into the pharmacokinetic study. The results of all the studies I've covered with you have indicated that Epicor is safe, non-toxic, non-mutagenic, non-mitogenic, non-cytotoxic, and pesticide-free. So now I'm really interested in the immune modulating effects, since it seems that the product may be viable for the human market. So we performed an interesting comparative study in which we took one group of production employees in Cedar Rapids who are exposed to Epicor, and then we took a gender-age-matched non-production facility employee control group and had blood samples taken for analyses of lymphocyte subpopulations, for RBC total glutathione, and an autoimmune panel. Additionally, we wanted to also look at saliva samples to determine secretory immunoglobulin A levels, oftentimes referred to as IgA. What we found was fascinating, and this is when things got really exciting, because when we compared the blood samples to the control groups, the exposed group showed a significant decrease in CD8, which are suppressor cells, and a significantly higher CD4, which are known as helper cells, so that the CD4 to CD8 ratio would suggest that these individuals who are exposed to Epicor have at least 2 to 3 times the natural killing activity against viruses, bacteria, and cancer cells than we would normally expect in people. And this was quite striking to the laboratory, which had never seen immune blood samples like this before. In fact, the director called me and said, "Alex, I've never seen anything like these results before. These people seem virtually immune from getting almost anything." Can you tell me what this is? And unfortunately, we couldn't at the time, but I asked him to go through the results and highlight the ones that he thought were significant. I had those results also. I highlighted mine. We did not hold the code as to whose blood samples we were looking at. Those were still kept by a scientist that's at the facility, Dr. Stuart Reeves. And then when we broke the code, we both had 100% successfully separated the production from the non-production employees based on their immune profile. We not only found the nice suppressor-helper cell ratio, but there was a significant higher cytotoxic activity of natural killer cells despite a significant decrease in their number. So in other words, what we've got to maybe use an analogy here is if we're sending out soldiers, we can send less of them out because they're more efficient at taking care of things. We also found a significant higher level of total salivary secretory IgA, and the levels, by the way, were over 300 milligrams per ml, and that was a real surprise to us, because what that means is that compared to controls or others who aren't taking Epicor, you've got this like envelope protecting all of the membranes, the IgA tract, your eyes, nasal passages, all the places where pathogenic organisms can begin to enter into the system. We also found significantly lower levels of immune complexes and much higher killing efficiency of natural killer cells and higher levels of glutathione in erythrocytes. So it seems in conclusion from this initial work that exposure to Epicor results in an enhanced adaptive immune response and improved natural killer cell cytotoxic activity, combined with lower levels of immune complexes in the exposed individuals that may be responsible for less inflammation and result in less tissue damage. When we looked at modulation of interferon gamma production, NK activation markers, CD induction, and a whole range of things that we've looked at, we conclude that Epicor appears to significantly activate a majority of NK cells, increase the ability and efficiency to kill tumor target cells, actually worked with K563 cell lines, for example, and significantly modulate those G protein-linked chemokine receptors. I think some of you may know these as fusin or CXCR4 cells, and then the chemokine receptor 9s, the CCR9 receptors, on natural killer cells. And the reason we're doing all this work is because we're looking at cell adhesion and cell signaling to understand the mode of action for Epicor. Then we've also found significantly reduced PHA, which is the phytohemagglutinin, induced production of interferon gamma, and we've determined there is a positive modulation on natural killer cells toward increased defense against tumor cells. So overall, what we're seeing based on this type of work is that our body's primary defense mechanisms toward cancers and viral diseases, which involve a group of cells called natural killer cells, is that Epicor is able to activate human NK cells and to enhance their cytotoxic capacities, while at the same time causing significant inhibition of interferon gamma production, which indicates that Epicor also has an anti-inflammatory property. Well, before we reach that conclusion, we decided to do some work looking at eukaryotic nuclear factor kappa B activity. Now, that's a little bit technical, but I'm going to try to explain the reason why we've done this work. We're trying to understand how basically NF-kappa-B is affected by Epicor, because NF-kappa-B plays a very important role in inflammation, in immunity, autoimmune responses, cell adhesion, cell proliferation, development, and apoptosis or cell death. because it regulates the expression of genes involved in all these processes. The NF-kappa B is present in most resting cells in what we call an inactive complex with other kappa B family members of what we call transcription factor inhibitor proteins. And so what we found in doing research on this, we discovered that EPICOR modulates the expression of L-selectin, which are the CD62L human B cells, and NK cells. The CD62 is an indicator of initial interaction of circulating cells with the endothelium. But we also looked at B2 and B1 integrins, which are the CD11A and CD29, CD49Ds. These are indicators of homing and signaling on B cells and NK cells, and indicators of migration on extracellular matrix after tissue entry on both B cells and dendritic cells. And we also looked at EPICOR, whether it induces calcium signaling. And in conclusion, what we have found from this line of investigation into this mode of action is that EPICOR appears to modulate the expression of adhesion molecules on human natural killer cells, T cells, B cells, and dendritic cells, as well as induce calcium signaling. And I thought that calcium signaling was very important because calcium signaling is pivotal to the coordinated response of cells and tissues and organs within the whole human body, because it's well established that cells do not behave as selfish entities, but rather tend to form like microsocieties whose proper functioning requires a precise coordination of emission and reception of signals. If you dysfunction this network, that's when you get pathological situations that can range from anything like abnormal proliferation of cells to even death. So this finding that EPICOR facilitates calcium signaling between cells is important because it may explain in part how it enhances immune response to potentially invasive or potentially invasive pathogens. So what we wanted to do next is then have all of these results reviewed by an expert panel of toxicologists who have worked with products like this for at least 20, 30 years. And I put a panel together, which was chaired by Dr. Ted Farber, who's a diplomat from the American Board of Toxicology, he's a PhD. He was for 20 years the director of the Division of Drug and Environmental Toxicology and the Human Food Safety Program at the FDA. And previous to that, he had worked at the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, for 4 years, where he was chief of their toxicology branch. So he was our chair. And then on that committee, on that panel, we had also Dr. Norbert Page, a PhD, also diplomat, American Board of Toxicology. When he was at EPA, he was the director of EPA Scientific Affairs for Toxic Substances. He was also the chief of the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health Priorities and Research Analysis Branch and former director of Scientific Affairs for their Office of Toxic Substances. He had also worked at NIH, the National Institutes of Health, where he was director of the National Cancer Institute's testing program. And he was chief of the Office of Hazardous Substances Information at the National Library of Medicine at NIH. He's, by the way, a past president of the Society of Toxicology. But to make things hard on both of them, I found their professor, and I put him on the panel, Dr. Joseph Borzelica. Dr. Borzelica, some of you may know, is the editor of Food and Chemical Toxicology. He's been a consultant to the FDA, NIH, NCI, NATO, WHO, U.S. Army, International Life Sciences Institute, many other groups. He's the former chair of the Board on Toxicology for Food Chemicals Codex Committee. He's the professor emeritus of pharmacology toxicology at the Medical College of Virginia. He's also a past president of the Society of Toxicology. And after a four-year review of 3 years of research on EPICOR, they declared the product GRAS. So it is now generally recognized as safe. based on the GRASS self-affirmation model that was allowed by the FDA in 1997 as a proposed final rule. So at this point, it is GRASS. And we, at this stage, have begun doing some human studies to examine resistance to different pathogens for Epicor. These are not easy studies to do because they require IRB approval, since we'll be exposing people to pathogens. But I'm pleased to say that to date, all IRB boards have approved the protocols that have been submitted at various clinical sites. So that would be, in summary, a fairly good overview of the work that's been performed by our group at this end on Epicor. And if you have a few questions, I think I've got a few minutes to answer those.
Great. Thank you, Alex. Okay, so I'd like to invite our international guests to ask any questions first. You just have to press 6 on your phone to unmute. We'll give you a few seconds, and if you don't have any questions, then we'll go on to any questions that might be from anybody else. Okay, so does anybody else on the line have, we have Alex for a few more minutes. If anybody's got any questions, please feel free to unmute your phone and ask any questions about Epicor.
Hey, Alex, Dr. Chris Molinas here. Quick question.
Yes.
Is there any contraindication that you can think of, immunosuppressed patients or anything that, I mean, it's a great product. You've done all your due diligence. I'm thoroughly impressed. Is there anybody that we wouldn't want to use this with?
We haven't found anyone yet. We've been looking for any individuals or groups or genetic conditions where it might be contraindicated, but we haven't found that yet. And possibly it's because it doesn't so much enhance as it modulates. It
yeah.
seems to keep the immune system fine-tuned, but at sort of a more alert state, so that if suddenly you are exposed to a concentration of infectious agents or there's some pathological situation developing, such as a degenerative disease, that the body is getting the homing, the signaling, the proper instructions to cope with that in a way that optimizes the immune system's capabilities. By the way, I've been on it for 2 years, and during that time I've had no cold or flu. I travel for about 9 to 10 months of the year, around 6,000 or more miles a week. So I'm on airplanes, and I go everywhere from India to some very difficult areas of the world. And I've traveled with people who have all gotten sick on food or come down with influenza infection, and I have not. And I, you know, we share food, we together. Even my wife has gone with me to India during a time when I was on Epicor. Within 4 days, she came down with a pretty nasty a flu. I stayed completely free of all symptoms. And I want to share a couple of other things with you too that might be interesting as anecdotal information to tell you why we're going to do so much more research on this. That plant manager that I mentioned to you last year in August was water skiing on a freshwater lake in Iowa. And as he was coming out of his boat, on the back side of it, there's like a metal ladder. And he somehow got his arm tangled into it as he was trying to get out of the water into the boat, fell back, and in the process not only broke his arm, but also severely damaged the nerve at the carpal site of his wrist. He was rushed to an emergency room, and they found a complete break in his arm, and he also was told that he may only get back at most 10% of any of his ability to move his fingers or hand based on the extent of nerve damage. So that was a pretty bad situation. He is right-handed, and it was right hand that was damaged, right arm. For 6 weeks, he was on a sling, and in a cast, and then they put him into a sling. 2 weeks later, he came back to the hospital. They did another X-ray, and he saw the orthopedic surgeon, who could not believe what he's seen, because, first of all, he did not want him to be in a sling so soon. but they felt 2 weeks earlier that he had made such good progress with the healing that he didn't need to be in a cast any longer. And he noticed that he was starting to get back some feelings in his fingers. Make a long story short, within a couple of months, he had so fast healed that the orthopedic surgeon, who happens to be doing research and writing a book on people that heal fast and heal slowly, wanted him included in the book because he said that he had healed in 2 months as fast as a person normally would in 8 months. By November, he had 100% use of his right hand, which they thought was never going to happen. There have been also at the company some monozygotic twins who have given us some very interesting indications of some potential benefits for the product. For example, 8 years prior to my visit 3 years ago, one of the women who has a monozygotic sister, she and her had both been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And the woman working at the administration office in Cedar Rapids was transferred to the production facility as a bookkeeper for a 2.5-year period. Today, she has no signs, symptoms of MS, but her monozygotic twin sister has progressed and degenerated quite a bit. We have another situation like that where monozygotic twins were diagnosed some 10 years earlier with early signs of macular degeneration. The one that went to work at the plant for the next 10 years has no further deterioration of the macula, which was at that point about 10% damaged. The brother is nearly blind with 80-90% damage of the macula. Another thing that we've learned since this information is now beginning to be shared with other employees in the company, because they needed to know why another division was set up and why all this research was going on and all these questions have been being asked and why blood samples were being taken and questionnaires being filled out, that around the world, people were noticing that because animals were so extraordinarily healthy who were receiving this fermentation product, they were also taking it home. And now, all of a sudden, stories are coming back to corporate headquarters in the United States, all kinds of stories from people who were adding Epicor, to all the family were eating it, or they were taking it because they had been coming down with something. A good example is a gentleman down in Mexico at the Mexican facility who had such advanced rheumatoid arthritis that he could no longer play golf because he couldn't even hold the golf club. And he reported that once he had heard from the corporation why they were studying this so intensely, he started taking 500 milligrams of Epicor a day, and 2 months later he was on the golf course swinging and holding a golf club without difficulty. Almost all the inflammation in his fingers and hands had decreased. So, you know, these are only anecdotes, they're only testimonials, they're very weak evidence from a scientific standpoint of efficacy, but these anecdotes and testimonials are giving us areas in which we will pursue controlled studies to verify the extent to which Epicor has a benefit for people with various types of conditions and degenerative disease-associated problems.
Okay, hi, Dr. Schultz. This is Dr. Mitch Fleischer. I thank you for a fascinating presentation. I just have two quick questions. One is, what are the recommended dosage ranges of Epicor? I understand that it seems like 500 milligrams a day is typical. Is there other indications for other conditions? And also, what are the dates of the studies that were done at Immunosciences Laboratory, NAIS Laboratory, and at Radiant?
All of the studies, we've been using NIS, Radiant, and immunological sciences over the last 3 years.
3 years, okay.
All the last 3 years, right. We finished most of the work that was related to, like, Radiant, immunosciences, all the tox work, for example, all the mutagenicity assays. Everything was finished by September of 2005.
Okay.
After that, we continued to work on mode of action, which we think was a very important area to continue on, and that is even still continuing as we're working it all out. And we're now at that stage where we're preparing 5 manuscripts for submission to peer-reviewed journals, reporting on all the outcomes of studies that we have done.
Regarding dosage?
Now on the dosage, the reason why we use 500 milligrams, that is the allometric equivalent to what over more than 60 years has been found to be the optimal dose that's been effective in the wide range of animal species that have received these products, from chickens and turkeys up to cows. What I did is I brought together a group of scientists who are all professors at various universities in the United States, like Iowa State University, South Dakota State University, Nebraska, and et cetera, because all of these doctors have been studying EPICOR in animals in their laboratories at their universities for some years. So this gave us in one day the opportunity to extrapolate from all of the animal work that's been done exactly what would be the best optimal dosage in humans, and that came out to be 500 milligrams. So hopefully that explains it.
Mm-hmm.
We've also used an EPA model for inhalation particulate matter that we did at the production facility, and we've determined that on a daily basis through inhalation, the workers are taking in around 10 milligrams of EPICOR a day into the GI tract. And so the question was raised, obviously, could we go at a lower dose? But the animal work does not show that inhalation, like when it's used as a bedding material, is effective at doses well below 500 milligrams. But there's no evidence that going well above 500 milligrams, say like 750 or 1,000, makes much difference either.
Oh, I see. So then in the clinical situations that you've studied so far, this has been the maximum dose. You haven't needed more than 500 milligrams once a day.
Right. We've tried that. The other thing, I want to go back to the pharmacokinetic study because I didn't do that. Once we saw what the immune profile looked like of the production workers, obviously where we were very interested in seeing what over 4 weeks would happen to a group of 15 normal healthy people, to their immune systems, taking EPICOR daily at 500 milligrams. And guess what? Their immune system, and it started particularly being noticeable in week 3, was moving in the same direction, so that nearly the time they stopped the study, their immune parameters look very similar to the production workers. So it gives us an idea about how long it takes for this to kind of build up and starts having an immune modulatory or enhancing effect.
What's the earliest point at which you'd see the immune modulatory effect?
Right about 2.5 weeks.
2.5 weeks. Thank you very much.
Okay, Dr. Schaus, I know that you're on a tight schedule, so I just want to thank you so much for your help today and sharing this story. And if anybody else has any questions, please feel free to email them, and I'll make sure that we get you the answers that you need. And otherwise, this concludes our call for today. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.